Well, this morning, in this second hour of the program, we'll be talking with documentary filmmaker and author Michael Wood. He is the producer of a series that aired, I believe, last fall on the BBC and will be airing on many public television stations around the country this month. In fact, if you want to see it and in you're in the WILL area, you can see the program starting tonight. It's called Conquistadors, and it is a series that looks at the Spanish conquest of the Americas. It's four parts on our station, WILL-TV. The first two will air tonight at 7 o'clock, and then you may see parts 3 and 4 on the 16th. There's also a companion book to the series, which is titled Conquistadors, and it's published by the University of California Press. So if you're interested in looking the book, that's also possible. Our guest was actually trained as a medievalist. He then worked as a journalist before moving on to television as a writer and presenter of films on history, travel, and culture. A number of his films have appeared on PBS. He has also written a number of books that accompany the series, just to mention a few: In Search of the Dark Ages, In Search of the Trojan War, and In Search of England. He's talking with us by telephone, and as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And so if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-WILL or 9455. Any way that you want to do it, 333-WILL here for people here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have that toll-free line. That one's good, as I say, around Illinois, Indiana, any place that signal will travel, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Wood, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Hi, great pleasure.
How is it that you decided to take on this subject for a series?
Well, I've been making films about history for PBS and for the BBC in the UK for many years now, and filmed in many of the, you know, the ancient cultures of the world. And the story of the ancient cultures of the New World had always fascinated me, you know, the civilizations of the Aztecs and the Inca and the Maya, and in particular what had happened to them in the 16th century and what has kind of survived through to the present day. And it seemed to me to be a kind of wonderful subject to make a series of TV documentaries about. I mean, to be honest, you could make a series of 10 or 15 documentaries to tell this story. There's so many rich episodes. In four, you can only just sort of scratch the surface. But basically, these are among the most important, greatest events in the whole of history in terms of their influence. They are amazing stories with larger-than-life characters, and they're extraordinary journeys to do in the present day. So for all those reasons, you know, I was drawn by curiosity to the tale, really.
That I would imagine that there must be, it must be a difficult subject to approach in the sense that you are talking about something that was a very, very important turning point in history, no doubt about it, and something that, on one hand, one might be inclined to celebrate. On the other hand, it's a difficult thing to celebrate when you also have to acknowledge just how it devastated the cultures of the indigenous people who lived here in the Americas that the Europeans met.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I don't think there's any question of celebrating it. I think you can, you have to tell the story and you know, show what happened. You know, clearly it's a catastrophe for the native peoples of the Americas. And one of the things I was keen to do was to really point out that, you know, most of us have only ever heard this story from our school days, from the books written by the winners. You know, it's always the winners in history who write history, isn't it? Or, you know, most of the histories. And I think a lot of people don't know that the Native American peoples did preserve their own accounts of these, you know, great events, not only in oral traditions, but there are written traditions written very soon after the conquest. There's an Aztec account from Aztec eyewitnesses of the fall of Mexico, which is one of the greatest pieces of war reportage in the literature of the world. You know, you can't go and buy it in your bookshops, but the fact is, it is one of the greatest of works of its kind. And a number of writers of Inca descent also wrote their story in Peru. So, you know, these are events that are, I mean, it's not the job of a documentary maker to celebrate, and it would be, you know, probably self-defeating just to sort of dwell on the terrible things that happened and to blame. I think you tell the story of the events, but you also show how, for example, you know, some of these ancient cultures have survived down to the present day and still survive.
Mm-hmm. That is one of the interesting points, that not to minimize the cultural devastation, but the fact that indeed elements of the traditional culture of these people did survive, and it was because of their determination to, on the one hand, make whatever accommodation they had to, and on the other hand, they said to themselves, "We're going to continue to do these things that we have done. Maybe we'll have to do it in a quiet way, in a secret way, but we're going to continue to do it."
Yeah, I mean, there's been a million acts of resistance since the 16th century. And the beginning of the conquista. I mean, I was very struck going to the mountains of Peru, you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners have been there, and, you know, 50% of the people there still speak Quechua, the Inca language. And we went on a pilgrimage, which is being shown tonight in the second show tonight, up onto the sacred mountains near Cuzco, where... you know, I'll never forget it as long as I live. You know, you kind of trek for a few hours up to about 15,000 feet, and you come around a corner, and you suddenly see this huge camp with 50,000 people dancing, singing, playing music, camped out, some of them just in the open under blankets. And the object of their pilgrimage is, you know, partly Christian, but the real object is to go up onto the glaciers at 17,000 feet. And to pay their respects to the ancient spirits of the mountains and the life-giving forces of the ice, the water that irrigated their fields, and the spirits of the mountains, and they still do that. And to see that astonishing sight at the beginning of the 21st century, you know, was a real reminder that, well, you know, 400 or 500 years is a short time in history, and these acts of resistance, whatever you want to call it, still continue. Mm.
We have a caller here. I will get right to you in just a moment. For people who might have tuned in, I do want to again introduce our guest, Michael Wood. He's a journalist, broadcaster, filmmaker. His series, Conquistadors, will be premiering on a lot of public TV stations this month. In fact, you can see it tonight on WILL-TV, the first two parts of four. He's also written a companion book, which is titled Conquistadors, and it is published by the University of California Press. We do have a couple of callers here ready to go, and others certainly are welcome. I also want to mention, for people who are listening, that we had an extra copy of the book, Conquistadors, and we'd like to find a home for it, so we're going to give it away at about midway through. It's the way that we usually do this. We'll give you a telephone number to call. The first person who gets in will get the book. We won't mention anybody's name on the air. It isn't anything like that. We just want to have somebody have this book. So you can be standing by, and the first person in will get the book with our thanks and congratulations. And, of course, anybody who's interested in reading it can head out to the bookstore and look for it. We do now have several callers here ready to go, so let's start in with someone in Urbana on line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi, David.
Yes.
Hi, Mr. Wood.
Hi.
Thanks for the film work and books you brought for us.
Oh, thanks.
Really enjoyed the In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great.
Oh, thank you.
And also Legacy, especially. My only complaint about Legacy, they're too short. Each episode is too short.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
Find way to wrestle some footage away from Mr. Ken Burns.
Yeah, you go through these journeys, and you have the privilege of working in some of these great cultures and civilizations, and it's very frustrating when you've... It's kind of like a life experience as well as a job, you know, and it's frustrating sometimes when you've got to cut it down to the basics. I certainly remember on Legacy, we saw things that, you probably can't see now, you know, and things you never even dreamed of. Anyway, fire away.
I have a question. I read about this character from a poem called Gilded Man by a contemporary poet A.I. This person's name, so I can't quite pronounce it right. Lope de Aguirre?
Yeah, Aguirre. Yeah.
Aguirre. it seems like he's quite a character. He killed his leader and comrade and they got rebelling against
Spain.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story, and I don't know whether any you've seen the film Aguirre, The Wrath of God by Werner Herzog.
No.
The German filmmaker. It's an amazing film.
Yeah.
You should try and get that out on video, because he was a conquistador who followed in the footsteps of the Orellana and Pizarro, who journeyed down the Amazon. Orellana and his men were the first to sail down the Amazon. And Aguirre followed, you know, at that time when the Spaniards were still looking for these mythical lands of gold like El Dorado, you know. But the guy clearly in the end went insane, you know, and he raised his revolt against he murdered his leader, raised revolt against the King of Spain, decided to march on Peru and conquer it for the rank and file, you know, whose blood, he said, had won the empire for Spain. And in the end, the Spanish hunted him down. He was killed in Venezuela in the end, murdered his own daughter to save her from falling into the hands of his enemies before he was killed. It's an astonishing story, and the Herzog film is about that tale. And in one of our episodes, which is next week, we actually trace the prototype of all those journeys to El Dorado, the great expedition that Pizarro took across the Andes in 1541, and which split up, and a bunch of them under his cousin Orellana in a homemade boat sailed the entire length of the Amazon from the Cauca in Ecuador out into the Atlantic and it got back to the Caribbean. And their diary is an amazing vision of the society of Amazonia before it was destroyed, you know, when maybe as many as 5 million people lived there. So, yeah, that's the background to the Aguirre story. He actually went back to Amazonia with some of the original expedition.
Okay. Another thing is I like to comment a little bit about comparing working with the BBC versus PBS. Thank you very much. I'll hang up.
Okay.
Well, thanks. Yeah, BBC traditionally has made these kind of documentaries, but over the last good few years now, PBS have been fantastic supporters of this kind of film across the board, really. And I think PBS are going to grow in influence, and I think they're very big in the field now. And we don't have any kind of clash in that. You know, we're part funded by BBC and part with PBS, and we love working with our American colleagues here, whose advice and support we kind of value, especially in projects like this. So it's a good example of transatlantic cooperation, you know, and we've worked with US film crews just as we've worked with British film crews. It's that's the way it is these days. It's a kind of global business, TV.
We have other callers. The next is in Indiana, in Oaktown, Indiana, on line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Michael.
Hello.
I enjoy your shows immensely.
Thank you very much.
Would you have, in your coming show, is there anything about the Seven Cities of Cibola?
Oh, no. It's one of those things. Had we been doing, like, 6 shows... It's one of those wonderful stories, isn't it? It's a fantastic tale. And, along with the De Soto expedition which landed in Florida and spent 4 years in the U.S., it's one of those stories that we would have, I think, done had we had more time, had we had more shows. No, in the last episode, though, what we do is look at the story of Cabeza de Vaca.
All right.
Which, of course, kind of touches on that story, because those expeditions up to the Seven Cities of Cibola were, used information from Cabeza de Vaca's expedition. And, in fact, of the 4 survivors of Cabeza de Vaca's story who walked across from Texas to the Gulf of California, one of them was an African from Morocco, a very remarkable guy called Estevanico, And he was used as a guide on some of those expeditions up into the pueblos. So there's a kind of connection. But in the fourth episode, we actually retrace the journey of Cabeza de Vaca from Florida, the wreck along the shore near Galveston, the survivors that lived with the Native Americans for many years, learned the languages, and then finally walked across from the Texas coast to the Gulf of California and back to Mexico, and in the process learned something of what it was like to be to be the other, if I can put it that way. They learned what life was like for the Native American peoples in those some of the poorest peoples in the continent living in those the North Mexican desert. So it's a fantastic story, and we use that to look ahead to the great debate about human rights that took place in Spain at that time, because this is the first point in history when universal human rights and global justice are actually, formally put on the agenda at government level.
Could I put your feet to the fire? I grew up in a region with a lot of history.
Yeah.
Went through, grade school and high school. I could care less about it. And then there's a metamorphosis or transformation. Can you explain that? I've been around the world quite a bit.
Yeah.
At government expense, and I looked at something, like a farmer looking at a cow and not knowing what I saw.
Yeah.
I wish I could have. You had your documentaries back then, so I knew what I saw. But
well, a friend of mine in the UK always likes to say, you're always in the right place in life. You know what I mean? And it's all to do with the different paths that we take, don't you think, and the different experiences we have of life. And
I agree with that.
You get round to the place you want to be, whatever way it goes, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, I think also, I guess the sense I got of what the caller was asking, it had something to do with the way that we learn about history, or people try to teach us history.
I see what you mean.
And and the fact that it seems that particularly when we're younger, it may not grab us, and then somehow, maybe if we're lucky, as we get a little bit older, suddenly we start to understand just how we may be connected to events that happen other places and long time past.
That's a good point. Yes, I mean your experience of the world affects your view of everything, doesn't it? In the end, and also I think we all depend on having good teachers, don't we? I had a good teacher who was very inspiring and who told good stories. And the root history is a story, isn't it? We all learn history first of all from our family and our relatives and the old folks, and that's what history is. I can remember my very first history lesson was my dad had an uncle who fought in the World War One, in the trenches in the Battle of the Somme, Uncle Eddie. And I can remember being about 5 years old and on my grandfather's living room floor, and my Uncle Eddie kind of pulling his pants down to show his shrapnel wounds from the Battle of the Somme, and he kind of pointed at them and said, "That's history, my boy." So we all learn history from stories, first of all, I think.
We have other callers. Let's go next to someone in Urbana, once again, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. A couple of comments and a couple of questions.
Hi.
Looking forward to your series. I enjoyed the Alexander the Great thing, too.
Oh, thanks.
And though I'm a little bit wary because you're English, and I know the English were really the first ones to practice public relations with the Spanish Inquisition, black legend kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy your previous work, so I'm sure you'll do it well, especially since you just now mentioned the human rights angle.
Mm.
And I don't think... I'm just wondering if you, I've got really two questions, and one revolves around the idea that, Columbus was reprimanded and recalled twice from his travels for mistreatment of the natives.
Huh.
And in the end, despite our host's emphasis on the resistance of the Indians or the natives, they did make a society which included the natives.
Yeah.
In sharp contrast to what happened here in North America, where we pretty much obliterated and you know, in a genocidal way.
Yeah.
So my first question is, and this is the only substantial question I've got. The second one is kind of minor, but the first one is, what exactly happened? Because I know they had this sensibility in the beginning. They did not want to mistreat the natives. So what exactly happened that made the whole thing fall apart?
Right. And first of all, I agree. I must just say a word about, being British and doing this, because you're absolutely right, you know, and I feel slightly nervous about kind of, you know, doing films about your history. But so I hope I've done justice to it, you know, and it's true, there was a black legend spread in Protestant Europe and in England and Holland and other places about the Spanish. And, of course, the story is much more complicated than that. Now, you ask what happened on the ground, and of course, you know, the conquistadors themselves were very hard people, most of them. Most of them from kind of lower middle-class families, you know, these families like the Pizarros, you know, Pizarro was kind of illiterate old soldier of fortune, you know. Many of these guys came from Estremadura, which is a very bleak and was a kind of poor part of Spain, you know. Their kind of job prospects before the discovery of the New World was a kind of pig farming, you know. So and they were very hard, you know. A lot of their families had fought in the battles where they had expelled the Muslims in Spain and forcibly converted them. So the guys who were actually doing the fighting, and they were only armies of a few hundreds, were unremittingly hard. But, you know, they were operating on behalf of a civilization in the end, although some of them were kind of freelancers and had got their kind of licenses to go and plunder. But, you know, they were technically and in the end became under the control of the Spanish government. And there was a great debate of conscience over what was happening. And this debate began very early. You know, it began in Cuba even before the discovery of Mexico, you know, in 1511. And with Montesinos and Las Casas was even that early, the great fighter on behalf of the Indians was starting to publicize the atrocities and gather journalistic information, you know, as we have done over kind of Kosovo and Bosnia and Cambodia and any other place in the modern world. They gathered vast quantities of journalistic information to use against the conquistadors themselves and the landowners who were brutalizing the natives. And the Spanish government obviously was very concerned about this, and it became a big philosophical debate. And in the universities in the 1520s and 30s, there were great jurists like Vitoria who were arguing that they had no right to do this, and therefore this whole question of universal human rights began to be aired. And I think the Spanish government, you know, in the great debate, accepted the justice of the claims of people like Las Casas, who said that all the world is human, you know. You can't make this distinction. But the problem was, in answer to your question, that, you know, just as today, you know, politicians talk about ethical foreign policy, but when it comes to actually stopping on the ground these things happening, it was very difficult. Of course, the Spaniards did institute new laws, and they sort of changed the system of, you know, the farms that were almost feudal, employing native labor, and you know, they fought against this, but it was impossible in such a vast empire, I think, to control these things on the ground. So it's a conflict between ideals and reality, I think. But I think you have to admit all empires to a degree are aggressive, but it's a long story.
I appreciate the way you posed your answer, and I'm sure you, judging from your other work, I'm going to enjoy this series. My last question, and then I'll hang up. In the next 6 months, for the first time as an adult, I'll be able to be in Mexico City, but not for long. So I was just curious if what advice you'd give me if I had one day to visit some of the spots there. Where should I go? And thank you very much.
In Mexico City?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Mexico City is a wonderful city. I mean, it's a great kind of world city. You know, the civilization of Mexico has produced the most wonderful art and literature, and in modern times, just as it did in ancient times. And if I had a day in a city, what I tend to do is just kind of almost like wander, just to take in the atmosphere, you know, wander into the great old churches, wander around the streets of the old city, around the Zocalo. And if I had any time, I think I'd go into the museum near the Zocalo, the great central square, not the big National Museum, which is wonderful, but it's huge. You know, go into the smaller museum of the Templo Mayor, the great on the site of the great Aztec temple. And if you're interested in history, you'll see works of art there that are just fabulous. So I hope you enjoy the city anyway.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I just want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Michael Wood. He's journalist, broadcaster, filmmaker, has made a number of films that have aired on PBS here in the United States, among them the one that some of our listeners have mentioned, In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great. His newest series is Conquistadors. If you'd like to see it, the first two parts, first two of four, will air on WILL-TV tonight at 7 o'clock, and then on the 16th, parts 3 and 4. He's also written companion books to go with these series, and the one for this is titled Conquistadors. It's published by University of California Press. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Champaign County, line number 3. Hello?
Right. I'll have to just bring these two points up and let you react to them because I have to run. But I'm wondering how much time you get to spend on the Llorena, the woman who accompanied the lame Cortez. And how, it seems that that's really a fundamental story in Mexican self-image of them. Yeah. And most Americans are entirely, or most United Statesians are entirely ignorant of it. And then the other thing is the idea that in El Salvador, the story is that the Doce, the 12 families, who are up until more recently are actually the really ruling elite of the country,
yeah,
trace their lineage to the conquistadors. And I'll have to hang up and listen and watch tonight. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, I think in places like Salvador, these feudal regimes carried right down to the 1960s and 70s, and many of these families claim descent from the old Spanish families. But the story you mentioned that is very interesting is the story of the woman who led Cortez, if you want to put it that way, towards Mexico, became his mistress. It seems her name was, in Mexican, was Malinali, and everybody calls her Malinche in Mexico. And she's a very problematical figure in Mexican culture today. She was given as a slave to Cortes and served him as a slave. She was from a noble family, and she spoke both the Mayan and the Aztec languages. And as Cortes had no interpreter, but he had a shipwrecked Spanish sailor who spoke Mayan, that was the cumbersome way that he was able initially to talk to the Aztecs. You know, they talked to the Spanish guy, and he talked in Mayan to Malinche, and she talked in Nahuatl to the Aztecs. So that was how it happened. So she's a fundamental, crucial figure. And in the Aztec version of the story, they express their kind of dismay that a woman of their race was leading these aliens towards them, you know. Although, of course, you can't be anachronistic. You know, there's no sense that she's kind of betraying her country in 1519. She's, she lives on the edge of the Yucatan, and she's nothing to do with the Aztecs. But and she's a very problematical figure now for obvious reasons. You know, everybody's interested in identity in the modern world, and Mexican people in this very strongly mixed society have always debated their origins. You know, are we the children of Cortes and Malinche? Are we the children of Cuauhtémoc and the Aztecs? You know, it's a cultural debate, and a lot of great Mexican literature has been written about it. Plays and films are made about it. And these days, too, you know, her name is she's the whore, she's the betrayer of the country, she's the goddess of death. To be a Malinchista is to be a, you know, sucker up to foreign imperialism, an enemy of the country. So, and we do talk about this briefly in the show, although obviously in terms of the whole narrative, we have to get on with it. But we talked to a Mexican woman historian on the edge of the Yucatan just to give us a little insight into. And you hear a Mexican folk song about her, too.
Let me real quick jump in here. I sort of blew past my midpoint, and I did say that we had a copy, an extra copy of the book Conquistadors that we wanted to give away, and I want to make sure that we do that. So here's the deal. Here's the number to call, 333-7300. First person in there, we'll give our spare copy of the book to, 333-7300. And, of course, it is in the bookstore if you are interested in buying the book. Let me come back also just to the other question that the caller asked, that there is this story in El Salvador that the ruling families can trace their lineage back to the conquistadors. Can you shed any light on that or not?
I mean, I don't know the specific story in El Salvador. I've heard the story. I can't vouch for its truth or not, but all I can tell you is in many of these countries you can meet descendants of the conquistadors. I've actually met a descendant of Pizarro in Peru. And in fact, you can meet descendants of Montezuma as well. You know, these 400 or 500 years is not a long time in history. And there are many people on both sides of the great conflict, you know, who can accurately trace their descent back. Yeah, I've met a descendant of the fifth Inca as well. You know, they're very, very strong on keeping these links in the family tree, especially in Peru. Hmm.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Indiana on line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, he just answered the question that I was going to ask. That was about La Malinche.
Yeah.
But did you visit the house where she supposedly lives in Coyoacan in your...
Yes, where she lived. It's a mystery, isn't it? What happened to her? This is such a beautiful place as well.
Did you meet Rina Lotso?
Close to... No, I've spoken to her on the telephone. It's a mystery what happened to her afterwards. You know, somebody who was... She was such an important figure. And in all the narratives of the conquest, and in all the... pictures of the conquest, she plays such a role. But as soon as the conquest taken place, she seems to be sort of banished into the background, she and her son by Cortez. And there's some debate as to, you know, how long after these events she lived. But she remains a very problematical figure, doesn't she, in
yes,
Mexican culture. There's a wonderful book, The Labyrinth of Solitude by Octavio Paz.
Which, yes. And Usigli and Carlos Fuentes have written about her, too, I believe.
Carlos Fuentes has written a fascinating essay about her in his New Time for Mexico. And it's a great debate, and will continue, I guess.
Well, I would like to also address the caller a couple of times ago about what to do in Mexico City. I think the Museo de Antropología is a must. When you go to, it's in Chapultepec or near Chapultepec Park.
Yeah, I mean, that is a wonderful museum, huge museum. I was simply recommending if he only had one day, that if he was going to spend it in the center of the city around the Zócalo, then if you have one museum to see in that time, go into the Templo Mayor, because the pieces that were discovered there are so sensational. If you've got more time, oh, I couldn't agree with you more. The National Museum is one of the greatest museums in the world.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
All right. And to those people who may have been calling to get in on the book drawing, the book's gone. One person got in, and if you've thought about it, you haven't called yet, I'm sorry that it's too late. But certainly, as I mentioned, you can find the book in the bookstores, Conquistadors. It's published by University of California Press. And we have about... 12 or 13 minutes left with our guest for this hour, Michael Wood. He's a documentary filmmaker and author and has put together this series, Conquistadors, that will be airing on many public TV stations this month and on ours, WILL-TV. You can see the first two segments tonight, starting at 7 o'clock. And again, we'll just continue to talk with people who are listening. If you'd like to talk with our guest, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Clinton, Indiana is next, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I read a book about Cortez's conquering Mexico, you know, Montezuma, and I found that very interesting, but they call it a conquest, but what I want to know is the book I read was supposed theoretically written by or notes copied from notes by this historian that he took along.
Uh-huh.
Actually, according to this book, they actually got run out of Mexico City.
Yeah, they did at one point, yeah.
You know, escape with their lives if they were lucky.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. I mean,
it didn't sound like much of a conquest. I know he really raised Cain there, but...
Well, of course, you know, Mexico was conquered in the end, and the city of the Aztecs was destroyed, and it became part of the Spanish Empire. But prior to that, you know, these events took place over 2 years. And 1 year into the expedition, Cortes was driven, well, decided to escape from Mexico. There'd been a series of... they got into the city. They maintained their position there as guests of Montezuma. They then arrested Montezuma, the Aztec leader, and kept him under their control. But eventually the whole thing blew up in their face. And Cortez's lieutenant Alvarado massacred the celebrants at an Aztec festival. When Cortez returned to the city, having been to the coast, the Aztecs rose against the Spaniards. And Cortez then... and his men decided they were going to try and escape, and they decided to try and escape in the middle of the night across the shortest causeway out to the west. And, of course, they were discovered. They were trapped. The portable bridge they'd been carrying got jammed. And some people think as many as three-quarters of the Spanish expedition were killed, you know, at least 600, maybe even some sources, Spanish sources, thought 1,000. So it was the biggest European... a defeat suffered at the hands of the Native American peoples, a tremendous defeat. But Cortes had an almost implacable will, and he retreated with the survivors to the city of Tlaxcala on the way to the coast, where he had Native allies. You know, many of the Mexican peoples hated the Aztec Empire and were prepared to fight with him. And even after this defeat, the Tlaxcalans stood with Cortes. And he was able to reinforce himself with more conquistadors and build a fleet, prefabricated boats, carry them in bits over the mountains, reassemble them on the lake of Mexico, and siege the city. And the Aztecs were, by then, unluckily, had been devastated by smallpox. You know, European disease played a great part in this story.
So that is a rather accurate account, then, of one I read, or you'd think...
Pardon?
Was that a rather accurate account, do you think, what I read? There was this historian?
I mean, obviously, we have quite a number of eyewitness accounts. You know, Cortes wrote his own letters. One of the conquistadors, Bernard Diaz, wrote an account later of the whole campaign. There's quite a few accounts, plus the Aztec eyewitness account that survives in their language. So we know exactly what happened and when, and I've given you a brief kind of summary, which I hope kind of matches. I hope it matches the book that you read. But
well, it's been a long time. I want to read it again. But
I mean, it's basically true that the Spaniards suffered a tremendous defeat on what they forever after called the Night of Tears. But they were able to regroup and eventually conquer, devastate the city. You know, there was an 80-day siege and the huge losses in the Mexican population. So, in the end, it was a catastrophic, although heroic, defeat for the Aztecs.
Yes. I think the Spaniards got what they had coming anyway.
I think many native people thought that.
Well, thanks for the call. And we do have time for others, about a little less than 10 minutes, 7, 8 minutes, if you'd like to call in. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I think for us, it's not easy to put yourself in the frame of mind that these people, particularly the indigenous people, would have had when they saw the Europeans. I don't know if it's stretching things too much to say, well, it would be a little bit like people came from some other planet and landed on Earth and we came face to face with them.
Yeah.
And it seems that one of the things that anthropologists have wrestled with, not only in this case, but in other cases, is when indigenous people met invaders like this, how it is they thought about who these people were.
Yeah.
And is that something that you feel maybe you've gained some kind of understanding for?
Well, it's one of the questions that fascinates most when you look at this whole story, you know, and sometimes you're absolutely right, you know, science fiction comes to mind, doesn't it? You think of kind of Close Encounters of a Third Kind or Star Trek, you know. There'd been nothing like it. You know, one of the Inca, the son of one of the Incas said to the Spanish later that we really did believe that we were the whole world, you know, that there was no other, because we knew of no other. We had no other evidence of any other world until you arrived, you know. So you can imagine the shock. And you can see the kind of effort to kind of categorize the aliens that the Spaniards were by, on the part of the Aztecs, say, who, you know, their spies report back these strange floating objects, you know, their ships. They talk about their chalky faces and the fact that they wore metal and the fact that their food was this strange kind of white fluffy stuff, you know, bread, and they take the bread back for analysis, you know, in ritual terms, and they describe with horror the fact that the Spaniards have these sticks which spurt fire and can split a tree or dissolve a hillock, you know, guns, cannon, and they ride deer as high as houses that snort and foam, horses. So you see the step-by-step attempt by the Mexicans to categorize these people. And, of course, you know, there were those in the Mexican leadership who saw them for what they were, I think, and realized that they were just human beings, you know, and they came from another world across the sea, but they were humans who could be killed and just happened to have greater powers, you know. But I think among the main leadership, and especially among the priests, The worry was that many of these signs that they analyzed conformed to certain kind of prophecies in their own past that made them uncertain over exactly who the Spaniards were. You know, in the Aztec universe, the gods could behave like human beings. They were more like the Greek gods, you know. They could be vicious, evil, nasty, two-timing, capricious. That's the way gods and lesser gods could behave in their universe. And something of this, what they thought of as the sort of irrational cruelty of the Spaniards and their strange unpredictability may have made them think that, you know, they were possibly agents of some divine power. It's a great argument, and nobody's yet satisfactorily solved it. But I think you can be sure that the Aztecs went through a period where they were uncertain exactly how to deal with these foreigners. And that period of delay was fatal to their resistance.
We talked a fair amount about Cortez, and the thing that maybe sets Cortez apart from some of the other people that you write about, although this is one respect, in what respect he's like some others too, is that he was something of a free agent. He had no permission to go and do what he did. He just decided to go.
Yeah.
And it seems definitely to have been motivated by the potential for gain here, gain and or glory, not so much for home, but for himself.
Yeah. I mean, I think in both cases, these great conquests of Peru and of Mexico, you're dealing with the distances were so great. You know, the communications were so long. Cortez had originally set up his expedition with the governor of Cuba, and then they'd fallen out, and Cortez had gone off on his own. He'd set sail against the governor's wishes. So for that period, that crucial period, he was really operating as a kind of freelance, you know. And in the end, the governor of Cuba sent an expedition to try and arrest Cortez, you know. So there's a point when not only the Aztecs kind of in revolt against him, but his own side have been sent to get him, you know. So this is a guy whose, you know, nerves are made of steel, you know. He can gamble to the point where everybody's after him. And yet somehow in the middle, he still manages to stay cool enough to calculate the risks and fights against his own side. And Pizarro had got a license to go into Peru from the King of Spain, but of course, you know, they never gave you the license to do the kind of things Pizarro did, but who was going to know that far away, you know? They were so far below the equator, so far away from Panama, they were out of control as well as beyond any hope of rescue, and that gave them a certain kind of steely nerve in their dealings.
How did they, here we're almost at the end, so it's a question that I can't really give you a fair enough time to answer, but ask it I will. How did they think of themselves, what they thought about what they had done.
Right. Well, of course, some of them thought that they were in the middle of the greatest events in history. That's what they said at the time. You know, nothing like this has ever been done. You know, how was it that God allowed this world to remain unknown until our time and then let us do it, you know? So there's that sense. And on the other side, you get some of the conquistadors, like one of the Peruvian conquistadors, who on his deathbed wrote to the King of Spain saying, I have to unburden my conscience. You know, we have destroyed a civilization that was truly, you know, good and valuable. You know, the Inca world was a moral universe. The people were good. They didn't know thieving and lying. You know, they sustained each other. Their body politic worked for the people. And instead, we've replaced it with lying, vicious oppression, and everything else. And I have to say this on my deathbed. This is what, and I'm the last of the conquistadors, this guy says. You know, so as you might expect with such a tremendous event in history, you get to the whole range of feelings about it, from triumph to tragedy.
Well, this is a subject worth many hours of exploration, and for people who are interested in more, one more time, I want to mention that there's a series that will be running on public television stations on ours, on WILL-TV. It will premiere tonight, two parts. That's tonight at 7 o'clock, and then the next parts, 3 and 4, on the 16th. And if you're interested in reading some more on the subject, there's a companion book, which is titled Conquistadors. It's published by the University of California Press. Our guest this morning, the author of the book and the creator of the series, Michael Wood. Thanks very much, Mr. Wood, for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it.